The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Will the next big trend be even worse than the selfie?
Answer me this, answer me this.
Is relentless self-portraiture profoundly unhealthy?
Answer me this, Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Since we're coming up to Easter, Helen inadvertently provided you with a special little Easter egg of her own last week by accidentally uploading an hour-long episode, unedited, of the show.
I was really tired. I've been working really hard, and obviously I'm allergic to that state.
Which, it was only up for an hour, but apparently around 2,000 of you did get hold of this this precious, unedited version of Answer Me This.
Now, don't go acting like this is an incredible bit of bonus Answer Me This, because all that's going to happen is the bits that we couldn't fit into last episode because it was already too long.
Yeah.
You're going to get them again.
That's basically it.
You're just wasting your own time this week.
So if you notice that parts of this week's show sound strangely familiar, that's because some of you will have heard them by mistake last week, for which
we
apologise.
I'm surprised it hasn't happened before, to be honest,
exactly.
In 285 episodes.
I think, one in 285 times you're allowed to do that.
And I promise it won't happen again, because I'm never going to work hard again. There we go.
but for those of you who do like hearing even more of us than we supply you on a fortnightly basis...
Legitimate way to do that, very excitingly...
is we've got a show on Radio 4.
All about podcasting.
That's right. It is the 10th anniversary of the word podcast being coined.
Yes.
And to celebrate, Helen and I have presented a two-part documentary on Radio 4 called Podcasting the First 10 Years.
It's on at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 on Friday the 4th and Friday the 11th of April and on BBC iPlayer shortly thereafter.
Yes, and within that we speak to basically all the podcasters you'd want to hear from. So Mark Maron's
except
in there.
For Ira Glass, who didn't want to be on it.
Yeah, and Ricky Gervais.
But all the other ones.
Mark Maron's in there.
I was very intimidated by the prospect of speaking to Mark Maron because, you know, he's done 400-odd interviews and is really good at them. Mm. It's very nice to me.
I'm sure he was saying the same thing to Joan Rivers and Patrick Stewart that week. I've got to talk to Helen Zaltzman. My God, pod queen.
Well, I'm going to really have to sharpen up my bants. I spoke to the Night Vale guys, Roman Mars.
Theresa Thorne.
And also Richard Herring. British pod star.
Yes.
And indeed, if you like hearing us talk to Richard Herring, there's not just our Radio 4 show, Podcasting the First 10 Years, which is on, but also we are on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast.
And if you're thinking, you guys, I thought there was bad blood between you and Richard Herring from things that happened years ago.
Don't worry, we talk about it all in the show.
Everything, all the dirty laundry
it's
is
weirdly
it.
Weirdly like family therapy.
Yeah.
Chris in Mansfield. Helen, Ollie and Martin and Sandman, answer me this. What's the best way to get rid of garlic breath? Tried everything and I still stink.
Well, I'm afraid the most obvious answer is, as always, the simplest and the one you don't want to hear,
which is don't eat garlic. No,
sorry, Helen,
no.
But all the evidence would suggest if you smell of garlic,
don't eat it.
I've got a better solution.
Go on.
Date someone who already smells of garlic.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
But he's not talking about dating. He might be worried about stinking out someone who's sitting next to him at the cinema.
Well, who cares about those guys? I've heard various folk remedies. They all seem to revolve around things like parsley.
Parsley is a good one. A lot of herbs apparently help neutralise the odour.
Fresh mint, would that work?
Yep, mint, basil, coriander or cilantro for our American brethren. Thyme,
is there
dill.
Any truth in mustard? I saw online and I just thought, someone's written this article as a joke, haven't they? Swill round your mouth a lump of mustard.
And then you'll puke your guts out and
exactly.
There won't be any garlic in there anymore.
I don't know, well, presumably you just smell of mustard instead. That's
chew
not
on the mouthful of Jira.
Yeah, well, no, apparently if you do chew fennel or cardamom or cloves or aniseeds as well, but those are quite controversial tastes in themselves. So you can drink milk because that apparently neutralises a lot of the garlic stench.
Yeah, but there's very little that I'll eat with garlic in it and think, you know what will go well with this? Glass of milk.
Wash it down with milk. Or green tea or peppermint tea. Apparently those are the best. Because the mint, you know, is a breath freshener anyway, but they also have a thing that bonds to the garlic stink and reduces the volatile sulfur compounds. And if you're preparing the garlic, take out the green bit in the middle, because apparently that is the most sulfurous bit.
In all seriousness, can't you just eat less garlic or eat it less concentratedly?
Well, apparently the problem is only partially the garlic going into your stomach. The stench is stuck in your lungs.
And
I don't know how you'd get rid of that. Well, here's another question of stinks from Ben in Northumberland, who says, the perfume that my grandma wears actually makes me feel sick, particularly Ooh. During car journeys. I try
particularly
to...
during intercourse.
Oh, Martin. Make everyone feel sick. I try to sit as far away from her as possible when we're having meals out.
But that goes down well, doesn't it?
I've talked to my immediate family about this, and they all agree that it's not a pleasant scent, but they're not as affected by it as me. So, Ollie, answer me this. What should I do?
Have you read George's Marvelous Medicine?
I can't think of a solution to this problem that doesn't involve either an awkward conversation, an awkward Christmas present, or more awkward winding down of car windows in the middle of winter. Mm. Help! P.S. She's an amazing grandma, by the way.
Right,
which
so you don't
want
to hurt her feelings.
No, indeed.
Yeah. This is a difficult one because... if someone has bad breath, you can pass around the mints.
Yep.
And you can make it look like that's just for you, not for the person who actually you're targeting with the mints. But when it comes to perfume, you can't really spray around neutralizer or like Glade air freshener in
no.
the car.
And I wish I could, because I absolutely hate most perfumes. And when someone's on a train, so not even someone I know, blasting the whole train with something, that is very... What are you supposed to do apart from just... cough until you fall on the floor, rolling around in front of them, turning red to make a point.
No, well, I was thinking of you actually when I read this because I've worked with you for enough years now that I know of this dislike you have for a strong scent.
I am Ben in Northumberland, and Grandma is everybody.
Yes, you're always commenting that people are wearing very strong perfume, very strong after, and I don't even notice. So I think some people are attuned to it, and it's not about the specific smell. And I think that's the answer.
It's more the overpoweringness. And do you think that Grandma's sense of smell maybe has faded?
Yes.
With the passage of years. And that's the problem.
Yes. Therefore, my suggestion, Ben, would be sabotage. I think
fill her bottle with piss.
I think this isn't about the perfume itself, but the concentration and amount that she's putting on. So therefore, dilute. Go in the bedroom.
Oh, classy option, Ollie.
Pipette of water.
Yep.
One drop of water to every drop of perfume. See how that goes to begin with.
Or if she's using the intense perfume, you could maybe sneakily replace it with a bottle of Eau de Toilette of the same, where the fragrance is less intense.
Oh, that's very clever. Yes, because that's pretty much a marketing trick, isn't it? But it works in your favour here. Well, here's a question from a listener who famously stinks. It's Kate in Maryland.
Oh. No, she doesn't.
She says, Helen, answer me this. Do people live in old castles? How common is that? Do these castles have air conditioning added?
You don't need it, because castles are generally freezing.
Yeah, this is... it's hilarious when Americans think they live in castles because a rich person has built a mansion in the style of Sleeping Beauty's castle.
Yeah.
And actually, they all end up looking like the Playboy Mansion, however sophisticated they think they are.
Are you saying the Playboy Mansion is not sophisticated?
I think I am saying that.
Oh, really?
But you're right. Of course, British castles, less call for air conditioning.
Yeah.
More call for a very, very, very expensive heating bill.
Yeah, even if you're running the heating all the time, it is seeping out from 12th century cracks.
Yeah. I remember a sommelier telling me that when people are sniffy about putting red wine in a fridge, that's not necessarily wrong to store it in a fridge, although it should be out of the fridge for a few hours before you drink it, because room temperature... Yeah, room temperature historically in Britain and France is bloody cold. It's not what we have now. So actually storing it at room temperature is... sometimes a fridge is closer to what you have inside, which is a very hot room because of the heating.
Oh, so if Kate wants the castle experience at home in Maryland, then she just climbs into the fridge.
Yeah, essentially. Oh, I suppose that's what I'm saying in a roundabout way. But anyway, people do live in castles, don't they?
The Queen.
Buckingham Palace isn't a castle, really.
She's got castles. Oh, she's got
castle. Windsor's a castle.
Yeah, that's true.
But she's got her little granny flat in it.
Yeah.
So even the Queen doesn't really live in a castle, not really.
Yeah, there are still a lot of stately piles that are privately owned. It's so hard to make them pay because they're so expensive to run that they usually live in a tiny corner of it.
I'm actually astonished how cheap some of them are. I was looking into this online. You can buy a castle in Lancashire for £370,000.
Is it two up, two down?
Well, that is the same price as a two-bedroom semi in Elstree.
Oh, jeez.
It has, I think it was 15 bedrooms, a tennis court, a swimming pool.
Piddling.
Wow. And hundreds of acres. But obviously, I suppose, the bit that isn't included is...
It will cost you £300,000 a year to run.
Probably more. It probably needs £12 million worth of renovation to make it livable.
Does it have wireless internet?
Well, I doubt it.
And also... probably for the whole 15 bedrooms, one bathroom. They didn't have en-suites
in those
days.
They didn't do en-suites then. They just pissed out the slot in the wall, didn't they? Basically.
On the plus side, you can put an adventure playground in your garden.
Do you think the owners of Hatfield House and Longleat go out in the middle of the night and just get lost in the maze with a bottle of vodka?
I reckon in Hever they're on the scrambling nets because they've done the maze. They probably live in the adventure playground because they can't afford to live in the house anymore.
Do you think they sneakily get themselves an ice cream from the ice cream van as well?
Well, you would. Yeah, given the opportunity.
I think you would. And you'd bring dates back and say, "What? Velvet rope? Not for me." Step right over. You can touch that painting if you want.
I have been to someone's private house where there were velvet ropes, and I found it absolutely hilarious.
Well, it wasn't open for tourists.
No, it was just a massive house. It was pretty modern, and there were velvet ropes around. I think just so that you, as a guest, you always felt low status.
Yeah, that's just an ego trip, isn't it?
Yeah, an impressive one. They had their own veal herd, and they had two gold eagles by the side of the front door on pillars.
Wow.
But it was just this red brick.
Did they have a butler?
Mansion. Yep, they had a gamekeeper, the gamekeeper's wife. Everyone was just sort of predicated to make you feel like a shit, though. Whereas I think a real butler would make a tramp feel like a king.
Yes, make you feel very welcome.
Yeah.
If you've got a question, then email your question. Yeah, to answer me this podcast, googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast, googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast, googlemail.com. Hepcat. Answer me this podcast, googlemail.com.
Here is a question from Katie from London, who says, I'm currently doing my last night of cat sitting for my rich, distant uncle.
Dreams can come true.
He's got a lot of money, but he's very emotionally distant. says Katie, he has two very cute, very mischievous kittens. Oh, can you imagine, Ollie?
Can
you imagine them all?
I'm already there. I'm there. They're in my head. They're playing around. They're frolicking.
In your head, they burrowed into your skull.
I want a kitten, by the way.
It'll grow into a cat. You don't realise.
Well, the problem is, I think Coco is so happy at the moment. Yep. It's her territory. It's her space. I just don't think it's reasonable. Even though we'd get one from a shelter, you know, a cat that needs a home, I can't do that to her because she's an old cat and she's going to be upset, even though we really want the
kitten. How old's Coco?
Coco's 9.
She's got ages to go.
Isn't that what your parents thought when they considered having a sibling for you?
Yes, exactly. And they were right. I am gloriously happy by myself. I'm the king of the world.
You do piss and everything and claw the carpets.
Quite right.
Well, Katie says from her blissful kitten fest,
mm-hmm.
As I was sitting on the sofa reading the last few pages of my book, I saw one of the kittens knock over what I presume is a rather expensive vase full of the sort of pointlessly expensive stick things you only get in posh people's houses. That is absolute nonsense, Katie. They sell those sticks in Pound Stretcher. You know the thing about sticks? You can get them for free. From the ground where they have fallen.
Yeah, although they're going to have a scent of dog shit or grass, aren't they? Whereas these are some scented with jasmine and licorice and things.
Katie says, answer me this. Do I tidy up this mess while I'm absolutely exhausted and have already hoovered? I don't think that the hoovering is going to apply retrospectively to this.
Mm.
Or do I leave the mess under the assumption they'll presume the kittens did it in the night? When you put it like that, yes, do that one. Yeah. Leave the mess.
I'm not sure, actually.
Oh.
I mean, kitten sitting isn't as serious a business, clearly, as babysitting. Because with babysitting, there's no joy for the babysitter. Whereas with kitten sitting, you are there partly because you get to play with some kittens. So, you know, it's not such a ruthlessly financial transaction. But I think if a baby shat itself under your watch when you were babysitting, you'd do something about it.
Yeah.
That's your job.
You,
and I'm afraid if a kitten knocks over a vase, I'm afraid part of the kitten sitting process probably is you have to action that. You know, otherwise the house could be empty.
What kind
the point
of a
kitten sitter
if you don't action things?
Exactly.
They're not going to assume that you knocked over the sticks, I would guess.
No.
Maybe that's
what you can say
about.
The kittens knocked it over and I cleared it up. I think that's part of being a kitten sitter.
Yeah. Oh, the kittens stole some of your spare cash. Kittens.
The kittens drank all your booze.
Also, kittens, like baby humans, like to just put things in their mouths. And
oh,
what if
yeah.
they ate the sticks?
Or the shards of vase.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah, you've got to clean it up.
Okay, yeah. You've sold me on this, Ollie.
Sorry.
Have you been to the cat cafe yet that has recently opened in London?
I haven't.
Are you tempted?
No, because it's an enclosed room, isn't it? So the cats don't run away. And I think an enclosed room that smells of cats and coffee shop is probably going to be a bit rank, actually.
And other cat weirdos like you.
Yeah, but I think the idea is really nice.
Are the cats not a bit like escorts? You know, because they're just there to make anyone who's paid to visit them feel like they are the one.
How many times a day does someone walk into the cat cafe and go, "Hey, I'm just here for the pussy"? I bet they're so bored of that joke.
Yeah. And they've only been open a few weeks.
I know that my baby is the absolute best. I put Facebook photos up daily and my friends are impressed. Apart from ones who block me because they're jealous. Because their babies are so ugly.
Well, why not build a gallery of your kid on Squarespace with special pages for its cute feet and cute hands and cute face, so my Facebook feed won't have your kid all over the place. He looks like a scrotum.
Big thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring today's episode of Answer Me This.
And if you want to experiment with Squarespace, there's
and why wouldn't you want to design yourself a beautiful website that works on mobile and the desktop internet?
Well, I don't know, Ollie. I can't get myself into the heads of these idiots that wouldn't want that.
Yeah.
But if you do, and if you've used your 2-week free trial and think, I like this, I want a year of it with 10% off, then use the code ANSWER3 to get exactly that.
Well, how apt? Here is a question of web design. It is from Jacob from Suffolk, who says, as a way of making money as a teenager, I run a small web design business.
Well, beats a paper round.
It certainly does. I made a website for a client, continues Jacob, and he refuses to pay me. I realise I could have taken many preventative measures that would have stopped this from happening in the first place, like asking for payment before doing the site, presumably.
Watertight contracts.
But I didn't. So, Helen, answer me this. What can I do to get my money? Here are some more details. He's only owed £250. I say only. I mean, I'm saying only from an adult perspective.
I wouldn't turn my nose up at it.
I wouldn't, but I'm not sure I'd go to court over £250.
That's 20 minutes work.
He says, I worked on the website for most of a month.
Oh, £250 for most of a month. Jacob, you are running this business wrong.
Yeah, that's very cheap, right?
Or preparing yourself for a career in radio. He says, I didn't use any precaution because I didn't have any trouble with my other clients.
Head with a condom.
Because I'm a teenager, he doesn't take me seriously.
I can understand why now this problem has arisen.
Mm. And then he says, two details I think we didn't need, but I think just to flesh out the story are helpful. The client's name is David.
David, pay up right now.
Shame on you, David.
Boo.
And the second thing he says is, I don't want to involve my parents.
Oh, so he doesn't want us to say, why don't you ask your mummy and daddy to go around to David's house and say, please give Jacob his money because he's very, so won't leave his room. I assume that's not what they want. I think you have to concentrate on what about you as a teenager he is taking advantage of and counterbalance it. You need to send him a letter written in legalese saying very briefly, if you don't pay me the sum of £250 by a specific date that's about 2 weeks hence, then I will be launching legal action. That will probably be enough.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I think as well that when teenagers get into situations like this, because it is exciting, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Jacob's written to us because this is an interesting story in
but
a way.
What is exciting, Ollie? Well, it seems not exciting and it also seems sad.
No, I disagree. I think when you have a first experience in business, it's exciting.
Oh, brilliant. Someone's trying to rip me off. Yay!
Yeah, no,
exciting.
But, seriously. Yeah, no, I think...
Because it's adult. Is that
yes,
what...
Yes, yes. Right, I think Jacob's quite excited that he's having this problem. Isn't it interesting, this problem I'm having? And I think sometimes when young people in business try and counteract that, they sort of overreact. I can imagine the letter being too wordy.
Yes.
Too like, if you do this, I'm going to go on YouTube and I'm going to do this and this. You know, to the guy who's not giving you the £250, it's probably not a big deal, this.
You just want to keep it to the point. You don't want to say to him, I need you to pay me because I did this work for you.
Yeah, exactly.
All the extraneous detail gone.
And you don't want to put too much emotion in.
No emotion.
That's what I mean. It's a business transaction.
Anger.
Don't put all of these little jokes in that you put in your letter to us. Keep it straightforward, you know. I want my money.
Yeah.
Maybe bitch. Hashtag knee break.
Also, if David does have a Twitter account, go on there and just say, I recently did some work for @David and he has proven stubborn at paying, because businesses hate public shaming.
Also, if it is a web design issue, is there not some back end to the website you could block him using?
Yeah, good point.
Or is it, Jacob, that he didn't actually like the work you did for him, in which case this is a bit more complicated, isn't it? And maybe there's a reason why he's not paying.
Well, I'm curious why he's not paying. Is it because he's just taken advantage? If he didn't like the work, he should pay you a nominal fee for having done it.
Well, indeed, if the fee was arranged. Assuming you've upheld your side of the bargain, Jacob, which I'm assuming is not enshrined in writing, because otherwise you wouldn't necessarily be in this mess, then you should get the money even if he doesn't like it. But yes, maybe you should change the front page of the website to David is a tight-fisted asshole.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really make sense actually when you put those two expressions together, but does the trick. I think also it's important when arranging this work that you do it via email so that there is a written trail over the phone. That's when problems arise. You don't have the proof.
Plenty of lessons for the future, aren't there, Jacob? I think he acknowledges as much himself in his email to us. I mean, ideally, you should be looking at a 30-30-40 deposit scheme here, shouldn't you? He should have given you money up front, then a bit in the middle, and then more at the end.
Yeah, money on delivery, and then money on publication or something.
And that, therefore, even if he was unhappy with the finished product, you've been paid a bit for the work you've done.
Yeah.
Even if you've done a bad job, frankly.
Yeah. You've got 70% of the money.
Exactly.
God, kids these days have so many more problems than we had.
I had a business card when I was a teenager.
You, of course you did, you twat. Cool, you tiny Patrick Bateman.
I always forget you're like Rushmore, Ollie.
Yeah, I was like Rushmore without the hand job. I, at my Leavers Ball, gave out my business cards to people.
Ladies, hello. And did you get any snogs out of it?
Here's my fax number.
All I really remember is there was one guy who, he was a real drama queen, and he'd fallen on the floor because he was drunk, and he was rolling around on the floor saying, "Oh, my ribs, I've smashed my ribs." And even the teachers were pointing at him laughing.
And you said, "Here's my card."
Yep. Put a business card in his top pocket.
Left him to ride.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Did you have a good time at your Leavers Ball?
Yes. Yes, I did. Although I, even at the age of 16, 17 and 18, because we had three consecutive Leavers Balls.
Just leave already.
I could not get rid of you.
Even at that age, I found it less amusing than everyone else to be surrounded by drunk peers.
Oh, yeah.
I'm never as drunk as the other people around me.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, stop being so stupid, stop giggling in my ear. Even the people that are, like, flirting with me and throwing themselves at me, I don't even like that. I'm just like, can you just be a proper
show
adult,
me genuine
please?
Affection, you terrible people.
Yeah.
No, I agree. The things I remember from the Leavers Ball are Mr. Lacey, the history and careers teacher, dancing, hilarious, and the rest is just people puking and crying. And ill-advised sexual partnerships for the evening only.
I like that side of things. I mean, the puking and crying, obviously I didn't have any sexual partners.
Well, I mean, ideally you like to combine all three.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the intermission. This week brought to you by Answer Me This, episode 91. Available from answermethisstore.
Thomas has written in on the subject of embarrassing surnames that Ian Digweed brought up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He says, "I must point out that my stepmother's maiden surname was Bastard." We have a winner.
I bet she couldn't get married quick enough, could she? Every date she went on. Do you have a special question you'd like to ask me? Is there something that you want to ask me?
And your surname's not Shitpile, is it, please? Great. Listeners, we do so enjoy hearing your questions on the phone line.
We do so enjoy it. Lashings of ginger beer.
Charming. It's charming. So please do leave them by calling the following number.
02081235877.
Or Skyping Answer Me This. And let's hear who's been in touch.
Hi, Helen Orley.
Hi.
This is Oliver from Leeds, currently at the Leeds Beer Festival. We've been discussing Oktoberfest. Apparently it's not in October. Is this true? And if so, why not? Answer me that. Yeah.
Well, Oktoberfest is in October in that the last day of the festival is always on the first Sunday of October. So it's more true to say that Oktoberfest runs into October.
So it's more like preemptive Oktoberfest, but that name is a bit long, even with German word building.
What about Septemberfest?
The reason it's not Septemberfest is its origins were in an event that happened in October, so it would be perverse to... The important part of Oktoberfest is, in fact, October the 12th is the event that they're commemorating annually.
Right, okay.
It's just that for weather reasons, they brought it forward.
I was wondering whether also Oktoberfest has swelled as an occasion and therefore has spilled into September from October.
Well, certainly. I mean, the origins of Oktoberfest are that it was originally a celebration for Prince Ludwig marrying Princess Therese.
What a day!
On October the 12th, 1810. For that, they did the 1810 in Munich equivalent of Rolf Harris introducing Gary Barlow on stage at Buckingham Palace.
They had
a big event, and there were some horses, and there was some alcohol.
Classic. Some things don't change much.
That's right. And they all said, "Wunderbar, let's repeat this next year."
Yes. Do you think they had an absolutely massive bicentennial Oktoberfest in 2010?
Probably.
Yeah.
They should have.
Everyone in the country got to kiss Heidi Klum.
So it was such a popular event, this, in 1810, that the following year they had another party to honour the princess.
Mm-hmm. Not the prince?
Well, it was the Crown Princess of Munich, so, she was the local girl.
Oh, so he was just on bit of rough that she got hitched to.
Yeah, the equivalent of that little village that Kate Middleton comes from. What's it called? Bunbury or something, and it's every year it's in the news because they do something around the royals.
Right.
Anyway, then when it became an established tradition, Oktoberfest, and obviously suddenly became commercialised rather than just something the city was doing for a laugh, it was felt that if it was moved ahead to September, more people would come because of the better weather conditions in Munich in September.
Surely, though, it's time to rename it, therefore. No, I'm sure some places have them in May.
Oh, yeah, well, internationally, indeed. It's a brand, isn't it, really, Oktoberfest? Yeah. Everyone knows what it means. It means getting drunk and eating sausages.
And also now Halloween in Britain seems to be 2 weeks long. It seems to be the weekend before and the weekend after. People can get dressed up in costumes and get pissed. Because in Britain, it's not for the kids trick-or-treating. It's for adults who want to publicly booze.
Also, there's more people alive at any time, so there must be more people dead than at any time. So there are a lot more ghosts, and they can't all fit in the one day.
That makes perfect sense. Thanks for rationalising it. Now I hate Halloween less, but I still hate it.
Easter eggs as well, I suppose. You know, the festival of eating Easter eggs, that goes on for, pretty much all year. So anyway, lots of examples, all of which point me to say, why don't they do this with Glastonbury? I know it's around the summer solstice.
Yeah.
Why don't they have a commemorative event for the summer solstice and then have Glastonbury Festival in August when the weather's nice instead of June when it usually pisses with rain?
No, but sometimes it's baking hot. It's either muddy or baking.
But it usually pisses with rain.
I think it's probably for arable reasons. August, you're getting close to the harvest.
Well, I'm just saying, if it was in August, I'd be happier going to Glastonbury.
I think it would disrupt the cows too much. We went to the Bavarian-themed town of Helen in Georgia in the US.
Did you go there just because it was called Helen?
Yes, and also because it's a Bavarian-themed town and I love those.
Uh-huh.
But I've never been to Bavaria, which is themed after itself. and I saw a poster for German Mardi Gras. Which first
like a fusion restaurant of events.
Yeah, it's called Mardi Gras, a French term, and it was on a Saturday, even though Mardi means Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it was
Mardi meant Tuesday. That's interesting.
Fat Tuesday.
Fat Tuesday.
But the a traditional Mardi Gras then is always on a Tuesday.
Well, it's Shrove Tuesday in Britain, so we get Pancake Day, and in say Italy they get Magnificent Parades.
God, we get cheated, don't we?
I do like pancakes though.
I find it astonishing that there isn't a brand of beer called Oktoberfest, which is sold internationally. I can't imagine anyone holds the copyright for it, really. I imagine it is the kind of thing that Germans get protective about, like champagne has to come from the Champagne region of France. Probably, technically, an Oktoberfest beer has to be, it has to be more than 6% volume or whatever it is. But really, if Guinness had a brand called Oktoberfest, that would be a guaranteed seller around the world, wouldn't it? And then through October, you could do promotions here in the UK like they do with St. Patrick's Day. Why doesn't someone do that? Commercially.
Well, you could do it.
It's a missed opportunity. Well, I can't now. I've just given the idea away.
Yeah, but you're always giving your brilliant ideas away, and then do I see them happen? No, because you're the only one capable of making them happen.
One day I'll have that. What's that suitcase you sit on that was on Dragon's Den?
Trunky,
yeah. One day I'll have my trunky.
Do you know, whenever I see a trunky, I think, the little guy's won.
Yeah, exactly.
What characterises Oktoberfest apart from beer swilling? Anything?
German music. Mm-hmm. German traditional
accordions.
Silly outfits with dungarees.
Sausage or
anything? Sausage, yeah.
Okay.
And not just sausage, but like, schnitzel of the pork and the veal variety.
So just German
shit.
Stuff.
Yeah. Strapping serving wenches?
I assume so, yes.
I know that's a bit outdated.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it is outdated. It's a traditional festival. It's a bit like saying Morris men are outdated. No, they're not. If you have an English traditional folk festival, that's what you'd expect to see. That's what Oktoberfest is in Germany.
Someone getting slapped with a bladder.
Hi, Helen and Ollie.
Hello again.
It's Oliver at the Leeds Beer Festival again. I've just been informed that Panama hats don't come from Panama. Seriously, what the shit? I don't know what to believe anymore.
Oliver is having such a thought-provoking time today, isn't he?
He really is. You'd almost think the effects of alcohol were to overstimulate the brain and make you think that trivial thoughts were somehow more important than they actually are.
I would have thought from this evidence alone that the effects of alcohol were to make the brain very inquisitive about all sorts of matters. Well, Oliver's right. What the shit indeed. Panama hats did not originate in Panama. They just became famed by being distributed from Panama.
Right.
They started out in Ecuador, but there weren't that many hat buyers passing through Ecuador, so the hat makers sent them to Panama, which was a major transport hub. And thus everyone was like, hey, look at my cool Panama hat that I got in Panama.
Yeah.
And all the Ecuadorian hat makers going, why are you on as an Ecuadorian hat?
Yeah.
But the name is stuck. Poor
it's evocative of the place. It just feels right. It's like a Hawaiian shirt.
I guess
I mean,
so.
Hawaiian shirts, I'm sure, are from Hawaii.
Yeah.
But you could buy one in London. It would still be a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, all sorts of goods that, you know, look like...
Tartan looks Scottish, doesn't it? Even if it's from another country.
Yeah. Well, for instance, in a lot of the Native American trading posts, the goods are shipped in from Pakistan
because
it's too expensive to buy the real ones.
I find that weird when you're in the States, actually, that, you know, they're trying to find ways, not anymore, because a lot of them have successful gambling businesses, but they were trying to find ways for the Native Americans to support themselves on reservations.
Yes, and yet, on the tiny and infertile reservations.
And yet they open souvenir shops where clearly the mugs are made in China. You just think, well, why don't they make mugs? That's something for them to do, isn't it?
They do sell a lot of things that are genuine, but they're about 100 times more than anyone can really afford to pay for a rug or a piece of pottery.
I feel a bit mixed up about it, really, because I'd love to have that, like a Navajo rug or something like that. I think they're really beautiful, and the pottery is really beautiful, but also I don't want to be one of those people that has a Navajo rug in their house. Yes, I feel those people are bellends.
Well, no, I think people with dream catchers are bellends, people with Navajo rugs are worldly.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think so.
Or they just need a rug, and they like the style.
I bet everyone who is just worldly and not a bellend, though, puts the Navajo rug as a bedspread only in the spare bedroom. That's where it ends up.
Okay.
It's on the sofa downstairs for a few months after you've come back from America. Then it goes on the spare bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's never a feature that you every day think, I want this as part of my life.
I do kind of envy people, though, that have a house full of artifacts. I picked that up on my travels.
Yeah.
I picked that up in a souk in Morocco.
Yeah.
And it's next to my real Japanese thing that I picked up in real Japan.
Well, and the thing is, that is authentic even if the products were all made in China. That's not really the point, is it? There are certain products that are sold in parts of the world because they appeal to people's tastes from there. So there's still relevance in saying that this was from Mexico.
There's something weirdly colonial about that, though, isn't it? It's a bit like being a big game hunter, to be like, I've travelled the world and I've bought the most expensive things in every place I've been to.
Kind of, but it's also, I mean, you like looking at pictures of your holiday to remind you of positive things, and it just, you know, it reminds you that, oh, I went to China because I've got this chopstick or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, I don't think that's weird. The Panama hat thing, though.
Yeah.
What I think is odd about that, and again, Ollie's brand consultancy.
Okay.
Here. Stetson.
Yeah.
Country music.
Yeah.
Dick Tracy's hat, whatever kind of hat that is.
Fedora? Maybe?
Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
Panama?
Yeah.
Only character I can think of in popular fiction, and I could be wrong, you could be about to tell me someone who's really famous who wears one, is Denham Elliott's character in the Indiana Jones movies.
I could not possibly comment.
That's not good enough.
Well, Poirot wears a Panama hat sometimes, but often it's the Peter Ustinov Poirot who...
Yeah, but you think of the moustache with Poirot, you don't think of a hat at all.
I sort of picture the guy from Our Man in Havana wearing a Panama hat.
Now, I could be wrong. I'm sure if I went on the Wikipedia article, there'd be, like, lists of famous people who wear Panama hats. But off the top of my head, I can't think of one, and I think that's a missed opportunity, isn't it? Actually, come to think of it, there's some great hats in Indiana Jones...
Really?
Just period, aren't there? I mean, Indiana Jones's hat is incredible, that cowboy-type hat. And then there's the one who wears the fez...
That's
three great hats in the Indiana Jones movies.
The fez. The
hipsters are going to try and bring the fez back at some point.
They've already had a go
on the top hat and the bowler.
Maybe a tiny fez.
I look forward to the day that Ant and Dec unironically are wearing fezes, though. Bring it back. Not since Tommy Cooper has it been on primetime Saturday night TV.
Helen, Oliver, though life is full of questions, there are answers you must know. One. No, it will not fall off, but moderation in all things too. Yes, there probably is, but we won't find out in our lifetimes. Three, most people prefer Connery, but my personal favourite is Dalton. Four, if you try and slip a one, it would ruin your friendship.
Here's a question from Greg, who says, when you see a sign on the motorway or on the way into a town, it will say London 50. But, Helen, answer me this, where is that measured from? Who decides where the direct centre of a town or city is, and who measures it, and what is the exact centre of London?
The exact centre of London? Well, what criteria are you trying to measure there? Are you trying to find geographical centre or emotional centre?
Or grammatical. It would be between N and D, wouldn't it?
Population.
Population?
Yeah, population-weighted centre.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Well, like
that
are
now, as a statistician, what would that be? Just
it's
off the top of
somewhere
your head.
In City London, I would have thought. I mean, the City London's got a very small population, but if you worked out the centroid, it's probably there.
It's probably all the people taking pictures outside Buckingham Palace. That always seems to be where the most people are.
Well, this is the thing. I think if you ask most people for a central London landmark, they would probably come up with somewhere in the West End.
Yeah,
but the name is a clue there. It's the West End. Mm. Or they come up with Westminster again.
West!
Name is a clue.
So yeah. I was told as a kid that for most towns, the distance is measured to the town hall. Is that right?
I think it's usually quite a tacit decision on a case-by-case basis, Martin. Oh. I would guess in old towns where there's a square in the centre of the town with a crucifix in the middle or something.
Here's the market square, isn't it?
But then in Telford, where you grew up, Martin, a new town, what are they going to measure from, the front door of PC World?
I think it'd probably be that frog that blows bubbles.
But according to the AA, who of course have to supply a lot of this data, they say we've historically chosen the town centre as being the strategic point where the major feeder roads converge, which was almost invariably in the centre. However, as town centres are now often pedestrianised and served by ring roads and bypasses, stay with me!
Yeah.
The criteria become slightly more vague. We can only generate a mileage to a point that is on a fully accessible road. So I think they just have to go for the convergence of roads that is nearest the centre of the town, but not the pedestrianised precinct or Westfield or whatever.
Blimey. So in London, where is it?
Well, historically in London, Ollie, it was Charing Cross, but the original Charing Cross, which is actually on the south side of Trafalgar Square, where there is a statue of Charles I on horseback.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
so it's not far from Nelson's Column.
Nelson's Column would be quite a good unit of measurement, wouldn't it?
Good landmark as well, you can see it.
Actually, if you're in a car, you can't actually drive to Nelson's Column. They can't drive right up it because it is pedestrianised around it.
It's just a guide, isn't it? No one's ever going to go, what I really want to do is drive to the centre of London. You want to go to a particular place. You want to go to a shop or a home. And so just know.
Well, you say that, actually, sometimes when I've got my sat-nav on me, if I'm driving past a place I've never been to before, I made this mistake with Coventry, won't do that again, I'll think, oh, that's a town I've heard of but not visited before.
Sent to Coventry, that must mean it's really good.
So did you go to the cathedral?
No, I went to IKEA for meatballs. That was the best I could do in Coventry.
That's never in the centre.
No, but exactly. What I did, not knowing the town, is I said to the sat-nav, take me to the centre of Coventry. Mm. And it usually is quite good, actually, at taking you to a landmark that you think, oh yeah, I can see this is a place I would want to hang around. Because sometimes, especially in a foreign country, if you've got sat-nav with you, you don't really know what the centre would look like until you get to it. And then you're like, oh yeah, okay, big square or, you know, shopping centre. Yeah, this feels like the right kind of place to park up. So it can be quite useful.
Yeah.
But as I say, not necessarily the place you want to stop and have lunch.
In London, it'd be very difficult to park next to Trafalgar Square.
Well, this is it.
Entering a nightmare.
The reality is, of course, in London, how many miles away it is from you is scarcely the point. You're often less than a mile away. The point
takes
is it still
an hour.
Might take you an hour, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So alternative routes would be more useful to know on a sign than how many miles it would be if you took the slowest route.
Well, with Google's traffic alerts, only a matter of time before the signs are illuminated by that. It may be 50 physical miles, but your life miles is actually more like 300. Here's a question from Isaac, who says, Ollie, answer me this. What was the first ever pornographic film?
Well, actually, that's quite a complicated question.
Oh, no.
But only because, as we've remarked before, as everyone has remarked before, pornography is always, at the vanguard of developing technology.
I mean, is it a What the Butler Saw machine?
Well, exactly.
And define what would constitute a pornographic film.
Precisely. Do you have to see penetrative sex, or is it just titillation? If it's just titillation, you can go back to the first recorded images.
Or a Botticelli painting.
Well, exactly. But he's saying film. So a What the Butler Saw machine, which was essentially a series of saucy postcards sped up.
Yeah.
That would count as a porn film in a way, wouldn't it?
A dirty zoetrope.
So I think if you take a very broad definition of pornography, then the answer is 1896, the 7-minute long film that has
Queen Victoria's ankles.
Has at least four different names online. I'll give you them all because I don't know which one is the correct name.
Thanks.
Le coucher de la mariée. It is, of course, French. Of course it is. Dirty odds odds.
Marriage beds?
Bedtime for the Bride is a translation. Or The Bridegroom's Dilemma. And then I've also seen it on YouTube. You can actually watch this film on YouTube. As After the Ball, Après le Bal.
Wow. That's quite different then.
Yeah, all different names. And in fact, Après le Bal is dated as 1897. It's not actually that surprising that both the titles and the dating are a bit suppressed because the footage was suppressed because it was so risque.
When is the official release date? Back in those days anyway, if anything.
Exactly.
And particularly of this.
So this would have been essentially thought of as an experimental art house film that couldn't be distributed through conventional means, so you'd have only watched it when projector technology was available in someone's home or a gentleman's club. So, you know, this could have lasted 30 years, really, yeah. without anyone really realising it was available.
Have you watched it?
I have watched it.
Is it arousing?
Well, there's
Did
only...
Did you whack off?
There's only 2 minutes of it left, which even for me is not quite long enough to get with it. because the footage degraded over time, so 5 minutes have been lost. What it is it's two women. Mm-hmm. So interesting that even Classic. The first porn film was two women, no man involved. Two women, one is a maid... who apparently later married the director. Right. And the lady who's stripping off is undressed by the maid.
Yep.
She gets down to her breeches. yeah, it's pretty hot stuff. Then she steps into a tub. Then I think she does take her knickers off. So top half is still covered, but bottom half you see her bum.
But is she in a tub?
Yeah, but she's standing in a tub that only comes up to her ankles.
Right.
So you see her bum, and then she sort of bends forward slightly, and the maid pours what looks like coal over her, but I think it's supposed to be water, hot water, to wash her.
Right, but it looks like lumps of coal. The shutter speeds were different in those
days.
Well,
exactly. It was obviously some sort of, like, Ribena-coloured liquid, so you could see it on screen, I guess.
I see.
So, essentially, it's the old thing of watching a bum in the rain. It's that.
Bum in the rain. That's so French, isn't it? Yeah. Debussy would have written that as a piece of music.
But what's quite nice, actually, is she's... I wouldn't describe her as fat, but she's quite curvy. She's quite rotund, the lady. And certainly not... Certainly the conventions of pornography of a certain type of lady being appropriate for the pornographic form had not yet been
She doesn't have plastic tits, does she?
She certainly doesn't. She's got a quite wibbly round bum. So it's quite nice to see. And obviously, what's weird is it's so unpornographic by today's standards that it's allowed to be hosted on YouTube. I mean, it's not even listed as erotic content. I mean, it's PG, really. Yeah. I mean, you're looking at a bum, but...
Someone's mooning.
Yeah, basically someone's mooning, yeah. Mm. So that's the official answer is that.
Right.
But then I think, really, if you take pornography as it means now and pornographic film as it means now, I think you're really asking when was the first close-up of penetrative sex, because I think that's really what defines a pornographic film now. And I know you can argue over softcore, hardcore, and everything
and
else.
Arty stuff.
Exactly. But I think really that's the question. And therefore, obviously, you get a different answer. And the answer is either the satire, which is a film that may have been filmed in Argentina at the turn of the century, or may have been filmed in Cuba in the 1930s.
Wow, so still early.
Still early, but no one knows because it was suppressed and quieted. Mm. But it's in black and white, obviously. And it's about, I believe, two ladies that are having a swim. And a horned devil comes up and does the business with them. So it's either that, or again, if you could say, well, is that pornography? Is that just a scene in an arty film? The stuff that is definitely porn and only designed for arousal is the stuff that was coming out of Denmark and the Netherlands in the 60s.
Okay.
And I never knew why, because, you know, in our lifetimes, most of the porn that I've seen has been American. Mm. I never knew why it was a cliche that you have, like, Swedish porn.
Uh-huh.
You know, because whenever people pastiched porn in the 70s and 80s in comedy shows, they'd always put on a stupid Swedish accent, do stuff in the sauna. Yeah. I never knew why that was. And it's because Denmark and the Netherlands were the first countries to legalise pornography, legalise the making of hardcore pornography.
Right, and so, people don't see the distinction between Denmark and the Netherlands and Sweden.
No, well, Americans don't, no.
Okay.
So the first porn that a lot of people saw was stuff that was made in Denmark and the Netherlands legally and then exported through underhand means and ended up in peep show booths and stuff. Mm. So it's hard to pick a classic title from the 1960s, obviously, because, again, they weren't being made out in the open, really.
Yeah.
But there were thousands of them at that point. So I guess the answer to the question is, when the first porn films as we know them now, 1960s, when the first time penetrative sex, probably 1930s, when the first vaguely titillating, vaguely pornographic film, 1896.
Was it real penetration, though, with the satire?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. But I haven't seen it because it's not on the internet, as far as I can tell.
Too racy, even
I think
now.
You can download it from the BFI, but you have to pay. I don't pay for my colour pornography. I'm not going to pay for something in black and white.
You sure it's not on RedTube or anything?
I couldn't find it.
Sort of bestiality, that, isn't it? Mythical bestiality.
Yeah, I suppose. Nice. But I suppose that, as always with pornography, that's the cloak of artiness, isn't it?
Mm.
If you're doing mythology, then it's kind of like, oh yeah, we're making a statement. We're not just showing sex. I guess it's a get out of jail free card for someone who finds it.
And with that, let's bring this episode to a climax.
Very good.
But if you want a repeat performance in 2 weeks' time, then please send us more questions via email, phone, or Skype. All of our contact details are available on our website,
answermethispodcast.com, where you can also find links to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and at the moment, much more importantly, go there as well to see the links. We'll post them up when the episodes have been out, to our Radio 4 show.
And us on Rich Terring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast.
So lots to listen to.
Oh, plenty.
But don't let it stop you sending us questions.
Or coming back for Answer Me This, episode 287 in 2 weeks.
Bye! Helen and Laura.